So before we get to today's episode, we have some very exciting news. Copper and Heat was nominated for the first annual Signal Awards, which recognizes the best of the best of podcasts. So that's very exciting. Here's the thing, though. Take out your phone, go into the show notes. There's a link there, a link for you to vote for the listener's choice. Voting is open until Thursday, December 22nd, so you still have a few days to do it. Go ahead, click on the link. It would really help us out. Thank you so, so much for voting for us, and thank you so, so much for listening. All right, now to today's episode.
So I went onto Google and I did an Ngram viewer, which is fascinating in and of itself. I put in tasting menu, and starting about 1980, 1981, there is an absolute upward, I can't even say trend because it remains, upward, basically straight up of the phrase tasting menu.
This is Dr. Beth Forrest.
Hi, I'm Dr. Beth Forrest. I am a professor of liberal arts and food studies at the Culinary Institute of America and the current president of the Association for the Study of Food and Society. And please call me Beth.
The fact that it's now showing up in publications in a remarkable way is culturally reflective, of course, of how it's entered the mainstream in not just restaurant reviews, but how people think about their food and how it may be presented in their choice of restaurants.
You're listening to Copper and Heat, the podcast exploring the unspoken rules and traditions of restaurants. Two articles. One titled, Tasting Menus, A Good Idea Sours. The other, Tasting Menus, Can Be Too Much of a Good Thing. The first is from 1981 by Mimi Sheraton, the then food critic for the New York Times. The second was from Pete Wells, the current critic, in a piece from 2012. Both articles say essentially the same thing. That tasting menus are too long, they take away the diner's choice, and in the wrong hands, they can be overwrought and overcomplicated. Even written 30 years apart, both question whether or not tasting menus were really the future of restaurants. But as Beth said, the use of the phrase tasting menu has been a straight shot up since 1980. And despite the critique, it shows no signs of slowing. This episode is a tasting menu, made up of dishes from essential points in the history of the modern tasting menu. Don't worry, we're not going to be charging you $500.
Welcome to the Copper and Heat audio menu. Are you a returning listener, or is this your first time listening? Wonderful. We're happy to have you. Please get comfortable and pour yourself a glass before we get started. This audio menu will be six courses inspired by dishes that encapsulate some of the pivotal moments in what we know as the modern tasting menu. Please enjoy. The restaurant. A consommé made from boiling meat and bones. Before there were institutions of restaurants, the broths, called restaurants, were served in the late 19th century in France.
In France, you have the rise of the restaurants really coming out of the French Revolution. Historically, you had two choices. One was to go to a tavern where it was one meal of the day. At one time, you sat at a big communal table with whomever else was there, and you paid one set price.
These establishments were mainly for the working class, as the aristocracy had private cooks and chefs cooking for them in their estates. In comes Mathurin Rosé de Chantoiseau, who wanted to improve the health of the people of Paris through his food, including a broth.
It was just bones and meat cooked down in sort of a pressure cooker bain-marie. So what was the name of that consommé? It was a restaurant. So you didn't originally go to a restaurant, you originally consumed a restaurant. Chantoiseau also started adding additional things to sell. So he started offering these choices. And of course, what does the word mean for short list in French? It's menu. At that time, of course, it was off with your head, followed the aristocracy in France. And so some of these chefs really did two things. One, they either left France to work for other aristocrats, or two, they started working in these new institutions of restaurants.
As the aristocracy fell and their chefs started working in restaurants, two cultural things started coming into prominence. First, the importance of democratic choice, and second, the ways in which the wealthy displayed their wealth and their sensibilities changed, and that included where they chose to eat and with whom.
Because people can now choose which one to go to, it becomes a sign of your sensibility, which restaurant you choose to go to, and which food you choose to eat. So it's very much speaks to what you value and what you see as artistry within food. By the time we get to the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th, right, this has become a little bit more de facto, and these institutions are spreading now through England and through the United States a little bit more generally. But that idea remains of which restaurant you choose to go to is reflective of you and your person, right, and your sensibility. And it's against this that we have the rise of the car and the Michelin guide as an incentive for people who have status to go out into these more rural areas to find that which is special and unique. And of course, Michelin guide started about 1900 as a tire company to sell cars. So that's really the moment when we saw the first growth of this new class of people who started using conspicuous consumption to show status.
This is the history of restaurants that most are taught in the U.S., that the root of restaurants, and fine dining in particular, is undeniably French. However, that's not the full story.
Hassan, a seasonal platter of roasted abalone, octopus simmered, fava beans, sushi of sea bream, ginger root, and hyote tamago, a specialty that's been on the menu for 400 years. This hassan was served at Hyote in Kyoto, one of the oldest operating kaiseki restaurants in Japan.
Kaiseki is a genre of Japanese cuisine. And it's a genre of Japanese cuisine that emerges in the late 1500s together with the tea ceremony.
This is Sam.
Sam Yamashita. I teach in the history department at Pomona College. And I've been working on food since 2009. And I'm writing a history of Japanese food. It's a little complicated because the tea ceremony stressed the refined and perfect practice of the tea ceremony itself, and it was only to stave off the hunger pains of people participating in the tea ceremony that little bits of food were offered. And the word kaiseki can be written with two different sets of characters. Originally, it was written with kaiseki meaning a meeting of seats, literally, and it referred to both poetry meets and to tea ceremony gatherings, which were always very small because the tea ceremony would be conducted in a very small space. And so the kaiseki meal associated with the tea ceremony, you know, was quite minimal and not many servings were made. Now, kaiseki then of the other sort emerged as a simplification of a formal meal served to high-ranking warriors. And that meal was a kind of tray cuisine, honzen ryori, or tray, literally tray cuisine, where all the ingredients were served at once on a tray. And the tray had legs. And so as you kneeled on your cushion, this tray was brought out. And that comprised the onzen ryori, or tray cuisine meal. And that influenced kaiseki. And so kaiseki also became a formal meal. But unlike the original tray cuisine, it wasn't served all at once. It was served dish by dish. And at some point, and I'm not sure exactly when this happened.
The modern kaiseki pulls from Japanese traditions ranging from the 9th century to the 15th century. So it's hard to pinpoint exactly when it developed.
The second type of kaiseki evolved to consist of 13 courses. And that's the kaiseki that we know today.
Kaiseki now includes those 13 courses that flow in a very particular order, starting with saketsuke, or appetizers, and then the hasun, the platter that sets the seasonal tone for the meal. Above all, kaiseki focuses on depicting the time and place in which the meal exists. Seasonality and locality of ingredients is of the utmost importance, as well as balancing taste, texture, appearance, and the color of the dish.
Now, there are kaiseki restaurants in Japan that are several centuries old. And one of them is a place in Kyoto called Hyote. And I think the current chef is the 14th generation of that restaurant, and it's quite famous.
Rouget en écaille de pommes de terre. Red mullet, lightly cooked with crispy potato scales, served with a white wine, orange sauce, and rosemary. This dish was first put on the menu of Paul Bocuse's restaurant in 1969. As a pioneer of nouvelle cuisine, Bocuse created the dish to be simple and light, a rebellion against the traditional French cuisine of the time.
So, if we look back at the menus of Escoffier, they're very much prefix or set menus.
The dishes served on these menus were defined by heavy, rich sauces that masked the flavor of the proteins, and elaborate, complex presentations. And this cuisine classique, as it was called, was considered traditional French cuisine by the time we got to the 60s and 70s.
What we're going to have in the 60s in France, as well as the 60s in the United States, is this backlash against hierarchy. And so for us and for this topic, it's the rise of the nouvelle chef cuisines.
One such pioneer of nouvelle cuisine was Paul Bocuse. And it happened that in 1965, the same year that Bocuse received his third Michelin star, Shizō Tsuji, the founder of the Tsuji Culinary Institute in Tokyo, invited Bocuse to Japan and took him to traditional kaiseki restaurants. Years later, in 1973, Henri Galt and Christian Milau
coined the Ten Commandments of Nouvelle Cuisine in the Galt Milau Restaurant Guide, which was meant to displace another historic hierarchy, the Michelin Guide.
By rewarding chefs for following this new set of rules of modern cuisine. And these Nouvelle Cuisine commandments bore some shocking similarities to kaiseki traditions.
The lightness of the cooking.
Lessening the cooking time.
Creativity of the cooking.
New fancy techniques.
There's great emphasis on the freshness and seasonality of ingredients.
Fresh, local, seasonal food.
It's really important to respect the ingredients and to protect them.
Food in its most natural sense.
The French chefs go to Japan and are taken to some of these top kaiseki restaurants. And their love affair with Japanese cuisine began at that time.
The French chefs, of course, also ended up being influenced by the Japanese. And it fit into the nouvelle cuisine aesthetics, or what they valued, completely changed.
I think the nouvelle cuisine chefs saw that right away, that Japanese haute cuisine was a little like what they were aspiring to do.
So Bocuse and other French nouvelle chefs begin to incorporate aspects of Japanese cuisine. And yet, for years, they avoided identifying Japan as a source of inspiration.
Bocuse and others said, oh no, we're not doing Japanese stuff. And it's in that famous book on French chefs.
The book is titled Great Chefs of France, and it was published in 1978. In it, it was said that for Bocuse, the integrity of French cuisine was absolute, and that he rejected all suggestions of foreign influence, saying it was simply not true that he served raw food in the Japanese style.
for so long, French cuisine was the dominant haute cuisine in the world. And it had what might be called a hegemonic position. And I think things changed with the nouvelle cuisine. We've come a long way from the initial dismissals of Japanese culinary influence.
Later in his career, Bocuse was quoted as saying, "I never expected the influence of Japan to be as great as it is." Whether that was in reference to his own cuisine is unclear. But what did become clear is that Japanese cuisine continued to have a huge influence on fine dining following the nouvelle chefs in the 70s.
Sukiyaki, thinly sliced beef, tofu, and seasonal vegetables cooked in a hot pot with broth made with soy sauce, sake, and MSG. This dish was popularized as a national dish of Japan and a favorite amongst middle-class Japanese immigrants and adventurous white eaters in the 1930s.
I remember we used to go to Providence at least once a year in LA. And at some point around 2011 or 2012, we discovered that the first dish in Simarusti's tasting menu was sashimi. And he used the term sashimi, and I thought, what is going on? You know, how is this possible? Sashimi at a top Michelin-starred continental restaurant in Los Angeles. And after I had the sashimi at Providence, it bothered me that I didn't understand what was happening.
This started Sam on his research of something he calls the Japanese turn in fine dining, which occurred starting in the 70s with the nouvelle chefs. But even before nouvelle cuisine came to the U.S., something else was happening.
How a cuisine climbs in prestige and value. This is called the sociology of value and sociology of evaluation. And this happened to Japanese cuisine. This happened to Italian cuisine right in front of our eyes.
This is Krishnendu.
I'm Krishnendu Ray. I'm a professor of food studies at NYU.
He wrote a book called The Ethnic Restaurateur that, among many other things, explores how different immigrant foods went from ethnic cuisines targeted toward their own immigrant communities to widespread popularity in the U.S. And as Krishnendu says, that happened to Italian food throughout the 20th century, and we're seeing it happen with Japanese food. So how does a cuisine climb in prestige and value?
I think the first thing to note is one has to have a historical perspective on it. The Japanese we knew in American history were mostly working class people, poor to middle class people on the West Coast in Hawaii. There's a beautiful piece, I think I write about it in my book, a 1939 study about American conception about Japanese food. It is seen as poor people's food, very rice-based, which, by the way, in American imagination has always been associated with the food of the poor Asians. Okay, it's only now that it is acquiring prestige.
And according to Krishnendu, three things happened to make that possible for Japan. First,
the end of the in-migration of the poor Japanese.
Second,
the rise of Japan as a major economic and a cultural power.
And third,
the in-migration of Japanese managers and cultural entrepreneurs into the United States. So one is what sociologists call the contamination effect of class, poor people, okay? So that immigration has to stop. And that stopped, in fact, in the case of Japan, with the rise of Japan as a modern economic power, and Japan will eventually become an imperial power.
Second,
the rise of Japan as a major economic and a cultural power, Japanese prestige then flows across global networks, and Japanese culture begins to influence European culture. If you ever wondered why Impressionism looks like the way it looks like, it is very strongly influenced by Japonoseri, which is an appreciation of Japanese watercolor on paper and on silk. So there's a prestige associated with Japanese culture that becomes soft power that I think can be translated into cuisine.
And third,
the in-migration of Japanese managers and cultural entrepreneurs into the United States. Remember, Japan was a major economic power 1970s, 1980s, okay? They ate up the American competition in cars. So there was an anti-Japanese hysteria, anti-Asian hysteria, but who are the Japanese most Americans met? They were mostly basically downtown Japanese living in expensive hotels for a few weeks, for a few months. That's why, by the way, all the great expensive Japanese restaurants were often downtown, not in the old ethnic neighborhoods. So Japanese food becomes highly valued and expensive, and we are moving from basically sukiyaki to sushi. That's the transition.
Toro and caviar. Fatty toro, or tuna belly, is chopped finely into a tartare that's topped with Ocetra caviar, a squeeze of lime, and chives. On the side is a grilled milk bread. This dish, created by Masa Takayama, represents his transition from sushi chef in Tokyo to opening his own sushi restaurant in LA in 1987, a pivotal time for Japanese cuisine in the U.S.
I was really thinking of the Japanese turn as operating at the nuts and bolts level of fine dining.
As Krishnendu said, this cultural shift for Japanese cuisine in the U.S. was indicated by the transition between the popularity of sukiyaki and sushi, with sushi showing the rise in prestige and value of Japanese cuisine. And this brings us back to Sam's research into the Japanese turn.
The first stage of the Japanese turn is when the French chefs go to Japan and are taken to some of these top kaiseki restaurants. And the second stage then takes place in Los Angeles. And it's when Roy Yamaguchi invents what he called Euro-Asian cuisine in 1980 at a restaurant called Le Gourmet in Los Angeles.
And following Le Gourmet, several other restaurants start to open with that same flair.
They're all cooking the new Euro-Asian cuisine and beginning to use not only Japanese ingredients, but Japanese techniques. In the third stage, the Japanese turn comes to New York, and this unlikely successful restaurateur, Barry Wine, makes his Japanese turn.
Barry Wine was the chef owner of the Quilted Giraffe in New York that opened as a Nouvelle Cuisine restaurant in 1979.
But what's interesting is that Wine used the French degustation format, and it was some Japanese customers in the early 1980s who said, you know, this seems really Japanese. They were the ones that pointed it out to him. And I think they arranged a trip to Japan. And of course, Wine went to kaiseki restaurants. And he had the same experience, the Nouvelle Cuisine chefs, when they first went to Japan. In that third Japanese turn in New York, the chefs still don't know exactly what to do. You know, they slowly discover Japanese ingredients. And so they talk about miso and soy sauce, dried kelp, kombu. And then a lot of chefs also began to eat sushi.
Up until this point, Japanese cuisine in the U.S. had been, as we talked about in the previous course, more focused on middle-class immigrant dishes like sukiyaki. But then, as sushi started to become more popular, in 1987, Nobu Matsuhisa opened his first restaurant in L.A., combining his experience as a sushi chef with Peruvian cuisine.
There is something that I would call the Matsuhisa effect, because he raised the price point of Japanese cuisine. And so several chefs who worked for Matsuhisa then left to open their own sushi places in L.A. But then the other thing that happens as part of the Matsuhisa effect is that a chef named Masa Takayama opens a little restaurant in a strip mall on Wilshire Boulevard called Ginza Sushiko.
Ginza Sushiko also opened in 1987, and it originally catered mostly to other Japanese people. But it quickly gained notoriety as being the most expensive restaurant in L.A. and a place for people who were in the know about food.
And it was incredibly expensive for the 1980s. It was like $125 or $150. So as part of the Matsuhisa effect, you have the elevation of the price point, which is then further elevated by Masa Takayama.
This Matsuhisa effect isn't a part of what Sam considers the Japanese turn, but it was a significant point in the history of Japanese cuisine and its effect on fine dining in the U.S. Through the 80s and 90s, the influence of Japanese culinary techniques and ingredients grow in prominence. But it wasn't just the effects on cuisine, but cultural ones in the kitchen as well.
There's another dimension that nobody has talked about. It's a little slippery. One of the things that happens in the 1970s and 80s, when Japanese cooks and culinary students begin to appear in French restaurants, the Japanese chefs make an impression. They're admired because, of course, they're hardworking and conscientious and they don't complain. But there's a kind of a high degree of professionalism. And what I think Western chefs don't understand is that all traditional Japanese arts are based on a form of spiritual practice that comes out of Zen Buddhism. And it's a form of spiritual practice that stresses selflessness and transcending ego. I don't know how else to put it. It's the spiritual practice that underlies all the traditional Japanese arts, even Japanese high school baseball, that, you know, suck it up, buddy. It's 35 degrees out and you're here in your loincloth as part of your baseball preparation. Suck it up. It doesn't matter. And so the assumption is that for X number of years, you don't ask why, you just do what you're taught.
This idea wasn't unique to Japanese culture, though the spiritual basis for it was maybe different than the militaristic origin of French fine dining. And it's incredibly apparent in the culture of sushi and sashimi.
The other part of this, of course, is that there's some physical violence. I saw this when I was at Jiro, not the original Tsukiyabashi Jiro, because I couldn't get a reservation. I went to his son's restaurant, and I was there, and it was a wonderful meal, and Jiro's son was making sushi, cutting some fish, and one of the workers happened to brush his body, to touch him as he was cutting. And he stopped, and he gave that worker the dirtiest look, and then he picked up this fish, and he just tossed it in the trash in front of all the customers as a way of saying, you know, you fucked up. You screwed up. How dare you?
This culture of perfection is prevalent in fine dining all over the world. And it's one of the reasons that Japanese cuisine has become so embedded in modern fine dining and tasty menus. And much like they did in the 60s and 70s when French chefs started working with more Japanese cooks, fine dining chefs today are enamored with what is seen as the perfection inherent in Japanese cuisine.
That's when I stopped going there because I thought, you know, labor practices like that might have worked in the 1600s and 1700s and 1800s, but this is the 21st century and that's bullshit. You can't do that.
Nixtamalized butternut squash and thatcha with labneh and amaranth. A reimagined version of a pre-Hispanic dessert from what is now Mexico. This dish was on the menu of Lengua Madre in New Orleans, a restaurant with a five-course tasting menu rooted in traditional Mexican cuisine. It opened in 2021, and Chef Ana Castro has been recognized as a Food and Wine Best New Chef in 2022, a Best New Restaurant by Bon Appetit in 2022, and a New York Times Favorite Restaurant in 2021.
One byproduct of the Nouvelle Cuisine is the menu de dégustation, or tasty menu, that is offered in many restaurants here and in France, and that is perhaps being overworked. This is a quote from Mimi Sheraton, the New York Times food critic in 1981. At the beginning of the episode, I mentioned two articles, written 30 years apart, about tasty menus. To Mimi Sheraton in the 1980s, the rise of the tasty menu indicated the downfall of taste. She thought that chefs were getting lazy because they wanted to have more control over what diners ordered. And she also thought that tasty menus meant that diners with less options for choice could not display their sensibilities of taste or know what's good without being told. If we think back to the very first course and the two big cultural changes in France after the revolution, democratic choice and using food choice as a means to display wealth and taste, Sheraton saw the tasty menu as an antithesis to the purpose of dining. But now, 40 years later, chefs and diners are using tasting menus to do something different.
If we go back to the idea of democracy, right, where it was the diner who chose, now it's the chef telling us. So the chef has gone back to being a little bit more authoritarian in terms of having the taste and being set for telling the diner what is correct. So the craftsperson has become the person with a lot more agency over the food. And so there's this constant pressure to always improve, to always push the line perhaps even further. So while I think it can be a wonderful opportunity for creative artists to use food as a medium, is there also a danger in that it can never be enough? I think a lot of chefs are kind of over it. They're tired of using the tweezers. They just want food that tastes really delicious.
30 years after Mimi Sheraton published her piece about tasting menus, Pete Wells, the current New York Times food critic, published a piece in 2012 questioning the format, saying, quote, "It's my job to urge readers to try the best. So I can't feel good about watching great restaurants that were already serving an elite audience taking themselves further out of reach. The elite who now fill these dining rooms are a particular kind of diner, the big game hunters, out to bag as many trophy restaurants as they can." End quote. 10 years ago, and this criticism is still being used for tasting menus. How has that changed?
I think in some ways it has not changed, right? In that it still allows this relationship between the chef and the diner. I think in a couple ways, what we're seeing is the continuation of a performance, both by the chef and by the diner, and it still showcases a great deal of capital. And I would say that's on both sides. Capital in terms of economics, who can afford these tasting menus? They're, you know, upwards of $300, $400 per diner, not including wine in some cases. It's also reflective of social capital in that once you are part of those who eat at restaurants with tasting menus or those who eat at restaurants that are part of the Michelin system, that all becomes a network of status in multiple ways. And the same is going to speak true to who is covered, which chefs are seen as valuable culturally, and who are not included and who are left out. So what does that say about who we value and whose artistry we value?
In the last decade or so, chefs have started challenging that perception of tasting menus, that it's pretentious or just for the elites or the Eurocentricity of it. And Mexican cuisine is just one example.
If you look at American haute cuisine today globally, it's basically American-Italian food with French inflections and Japanese accents.
Here's Krishnendu again. And in his research of immigrant foods for his book, The Ethnic Restaurateur, he noted an interesting shift in how cuisines make their way into fine dining in the U.S. And Mexican cuisine is just one example.
The Mexican example is almost the opposite of the Japanese example. Here's the interesting story. Mexican cultural capital is a lot more like hip-hop rather than like impressionism. It is seeping from the bottom up. It is the inverse of Japanoserie and French culture that tagged along and basically came in from the top and is filtering downwards. That's radical transformation. Mexicans are teaching us how to eat in the 21st century. It's not Japanese, which is kind of a global international network. This is a bottom-up disruption like hip-hop was to American music. So much more interesting, much more creative, much more disruptive. And you know what's going to happen? Like you have food in LA, the Mexican-Korean taco, everybody's trying to get onto that bandwagon. And so that is a symptom of how powerful this idiom is, how disruptive it is. And it is the opposite of all the stuff sociologists endlessly talk about, which is all about top down and all about domination. This is about disruption.
In 2022, on the heels of both Mimi Sheraton and Pete Wells, the New York Times published another piece about tasting menus. This one by Brett Anderson was titled "The New Generation of Tasting Menus Won't Test Your Patience or Your Wallet." With lower price points and less attitude, chefs around the country are finding fun and freedom in the once stuffy form. In the article, Anderson mentions a slew of new restaurants with young chefs, mostly women and people of color like Ana Castro of Lengua Madre, who are using the tasting menu format to tell stories and reach audiences that have been excluded from the narrative. And as the younger generations of chefs and diners are so much more interested in social justice and interesting experiences, what does that mean for the future of tasting menus?
I don't think I can tell you the future of tasting menus, but it's never been just about nutrients. It can be about this new aesthetic reflection. It could be more about sharing food together, or it could be about, is this food all ethical and prepared in a way that highlights different cultural practices outside of my own, in a way that also values not just the culture, but the people from that culture and their knowledge. But I would say that going out to dinner fulfills different needs for different people. And I think you will always have, because we always have had, people who use it for aesthetics, for taste, for craft, for artistry, for status, for performance. And that I don't think is going away.
So much for joining us today. I hope you enjoyed your dining experience. Here's a little takeaway treat, a cookie trio for your breakfast tomorrow morning. Meringue Kisses, a rumored favorite of Marie Antoinette's. Omogashi, a treat filled with red bean paste, traditionally eaten during the Japanese tea ceremony. Lastly, we have Alegrias, a traditional Mexican candy made with honey and amaranth. We hope to see you again soon.
Thank you to Dr. Krishnendu Ray, Dr. Sam Yamashita, and Dr. Beth Forrest for sharing their insights. I'll link to their work in the show notes so that you can read more of their research. Follow us in your favorite podcast app and find us on various social channels at Copper and Heat to keep up to date throughout the season. And we always love hearing from you, so please send us a message on our website or in our DMs. This episode was produced by me, Katie Osuna, and Rachel Palmer. Archival music in this episode is from the Library of Congress National Jukebox. Additional music and sound design by Ricardo Osuna. Mixing and mastering was done by Adrian Lilly. Thanks so much for listening.